Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest beheading of a Japanese journalist by the so-called Islamic State that is putting enormous pressure on the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan to engage in a prisoner swap for a captured Jordanian pilot in exchange for an Iraqi suicide bomber. A specialist on the region with extensive field experience in Jordan, Nicholas Harris, a researcher at the Center for a New American Security, joins us to discuss the important connection between the Jordanian king and the tribe to which the pilot belongs, and the political strategy behind the Islamic State's barbarism that is roiling the already fragile cohesion of the Jordanian kingdom, which is facing multiple challenges from the wars in the neighborhood and the flood of refugees from Syria and Iraq. Then we'll get an analysis from a leading expert on oil and gas on the major shakeup underway in Saudi Arabia as the new king reshuffles ministries and fires ministers while giving his subjects a present of a $20 billion bonus payout to government workers, at the same time keeping the price of oil low as the Saudis flood the market, driving the frackers out of business, while causing American oil giants like Chevron to post 30% losses in quarterly earnings. Fidel Geit, Managing Director for Oil and Gas at Oppenheimer & Company, joins us to discuss the shakeup in the oil patch and its implications for the future. Then finally, with Senator Lindsey Graham condemning the president for not calling the U.S. confrontation with the Islamic State a religious war, while Obama counters that the problem is not with the 99% of Muslims, but an element within the religion that, quote, have embraced a nihilistic, violent, and almost medieval interpretation of Islam, we will discuss political Islam with Arabic-speaking scholar Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council. He joins us to explore the deeper historic, cultural, and religious strains of political identity beyond nationalism in Muslim political thinking, where the Muslim level of political consciousness contrasts sharply with the Western ideas of nation-state. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New America Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And it's apparent that the Jordanian king, Abdullah, is being squeezed considerably. His own population apparently are 100% behind the release of the Royal Jordanian Air Force pilot, Moaz al-Kasasba. And apparently he's a member of an influential tribe, the captured pilot. It's not as if the king of Jordan doesn't have a lot of problems on his plate already.
This current crisis over the release of Lieutenant Moaz Kasasba is incredibly important in terms of the propaganda value that the Islamic State is trying to derive from it. There have been demonstrations by the extended family of Lieutenant Kasasba, the Barasha tribe. The Barasha tribe is powerful in Kerak, which is a city about 120 kilometers south of the capital of Amman. Over the last year and a half, due to a stagnant economy in Jordan, frustrated future opportunities for Jordanian youth, and also the pressures of several regional wars in Iraq and Syria that have brought millions of refugees to Jordan, particularly in its urban areas where a lot of rural Jordanians have settled. There's been a climate of malaise, a sense of stagnation, which hasn't eased. In terms of the ability of the Islamic State to parlay any type of frustration towards the Hashemite monarchy in Jordan into sort of a wider tribal war against the king, I don't see that. But what I do see is that this episode is the latest example of the bravado of the Islamic State and its willingness to take on sort of the established regimes in the region and to try to demonstrate that members of the international coalition from the Arab world, such as Jordan, do not have the same type of authority that they try to project themselves. And it reflects a deeper debate in Jordan over whether the Jordanians should even be involved in the international coalition. There's an active debate that has been ongoing since September when the Jordanians joined the international air campaign against Islamic State in Syria. But whether the Jordanians should even be involved in that, whether they should just protect their own borders, take care of their own population, and stay out of an international war.
Well, it's pretty clear that the Islamic State, or Daesh, as the people in the neighborhood much prefer to call it, there's nothing particularly Islamic about them, although they are pretenders to a new caliphate. And as such, they're punching way above their weight militarily and politically, but they are having an effect. These beheadings definitely get the attention of the global media. And the fact that they're calling for a new caliphate, to my mind, is probably pressuring the Saudis into more conservatism, because that's the very nature of the legitimacy of the House of Saud as custodians of the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina. So aren't the Islamic State's basic strategy gets at the heart of the legitimacy of all of these monarchs in the region?
Well, that's a great point. In terms of sort of the realpolitik of the region, Jordan represents sort of a shield for Saudi Arabia to the north. It's a territorial shield between Syria and Saudi Arabia. Now, there had been in the past disagreements between the al-Sharif, which is the branch, the tribal family of the current Hashemite monarchy of Jordan, and the al-Saud. And the al-Saud displaced the al-Sharif. The al-Sharif used to be the custodians of Mecca and Medina. The Saud displaced them. And there has been, from the Islamic State's objective, attempts to try to network with tribes that cross borders between Syria, Iraq, Jordan, northern Saudi Arabia, to try to foment some sort of unrest against regimes like Saudi Arabia and Jordan. You know, part of the interest in ideological appeal that the Islamic State is trying to present is that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the caliph of the Islamic State, claims to be a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, like the Hashemite monarchy in Jordan claims descent from Prophet Muhammad. He claims to be a doctor in Islamic jurisprudence, which is something that the current king of Jordan cannot claim. And he also tries to present himself as him and his movement as the rightful heirs to the Prophet Muhammad and the Islamic empire in the past. And there's that undertow, because in Jordan, one of the bedrocks of legitimacy of the monarchy is that it can claim descent from the Prophet Muhammad, that it had been the custodian of Mecca and Medina in the past, that it was tribal, that the Hashemites were the tribal elders of the tribes, that it was the Sheikh al-Masheikh, the Sheikh of the Sheikhs, and where the Hashemite monarchy in Jordan had always derived strong support from the tribes of Transjordan, or the East Bank, as it's referred to, the Arab tribes that were there, to form the core of the Jordanian military, the Jordanian National Guard, the Jordanian intelligence services, as opposed to more recent, you know, almost half a decade now, but more recent in terms of history, Palestinian population that had come from the West Bank and areas that are now in Israel. There was always that dynamic in play in Jordan, but now where you have mass migration of people from Syria and from Iraq that have settled in Amman, you have the increase in the urban population, the decrease in opportunities in Jordan. There has been, and this decrease in opportunities has hit particularly hard, predominantly tribal areas in Jordan where the kin and his father have derived significant support. So it will be an interesting dynamic moving into the future, whether the Islamic State will be able to, over time, parlay its own tribal alliances that it's trying to build in Syria and Iraq into broader transnational tribal alliances that lead to, you know, pockets of revolt, reaction from the regime, which leads to bloodshed, which leads to more revolt. This is sort of the stress factor or shatter point the Islamic State's trying to attempt this time.
But to begin with, it would seem, Nicholas, that the King Abdullah, who I think he's more comfortable speaking in English than he is in Arabic, actually, and he's perceived as being very, very Western in many ways, even though he does, as you say, have the legitimacy of the Hashemite line being the original custodians of the holy shrines. And this division between the East Bank as the native Jordanians and the West Bank as the descendants of the Palestinians is a very difficult fault line that he has to bridge all the time. And then on top of that, you've got this influx of refugees that are, and it's the same problem, by the way, in Lebanon, that the Syrian refugees in Lebanon are working cheap and putting Lebanese out of work and creating a lot of... So it seemed to me that a part of the Islamic State strategy goes well beyond these well-publicized beheadings on television. The war that they're prosecuting and the territory that they control and the terror that the reign of terror that they practice is creating refugees, which in turn puts stress on these other countries. So it's a broader strategy, clearly.
There's a lot of potential discontent that the Islamic State can take from refugee populations, and refugee populations do put a lot of stress on neighboring countries, as you pointed out, Lebanon, Jordan, maybe less so in Turkey because of the size of Turkey and its population base. But in terms of Jordan in particular and Lebanon also, yes, that is a major issue. And in Jordan, the difficulty with the refugee population is that something like more than two-thirds, by last count, of the refugees in Jordan are actually in urban areas. They're not in camps. They're tougher to register these people. It's tougher to account for whether their basic needs are being taken care of. It's tougher to keep account of what type of social networks they're forming or potential lines of influence Islamic State can have on them. And that's an issue and a problem that isn't likely to be solved in the near future. I mean, there's been so much talk about building up a secular nationalist armed opposition against Assad. In Syria, there's less talk about, okay, what's the end game afterwards? What does a potential post-Assad Syria look like? What do you do with armed minority communities that support Assad? How do you bring them back into a country? How do you demobilize them, disarm them, and reintegrate them? How do you rebuild that country's infrastructure? There are estimates that there's been tens of billions of dollars done to the economy of Syria. And then how do you resettle refugees? And the resettlement of refugees in the Middle East is such a tough political topic. You know, in many areas of the Middle East, Palestinians, just other than in places such as Jordan and to a limited degree in Syria before the conflict, you know, it's a political issue. It's an issue of, are they guests or are they residents? Are they citizens? And now with the Syrian population set and millions more people, this is going to be an open sore in the Middle East for a while that will need to be dealt with economic and social relief. And that can't happen if there's still an active conflict and there's still an Islamic State and other armed groups acting against order and security in Syria.
Well, it would seem to me, though, Nicholas Harris, that the Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, hold the trump cards here, because if they go ahead and execute this pilot, won't that have some terrible repercussions on King Abdullah?
I think it will have a repercussion in terms of the political capital that he will have lost. You referred to earlier the fact that the king is said to be more comfortable speaking in English. There was a sort of common joke that's been running for years that King Abdullah's kin PlayStation 3, that he's more comfortable leaving the affairs of state to others. And one of the points of emphasis that had been made about his father Hussein in the past was Hussein really did act like a sheikh among sheikhs, that he really did go to all corners of his kingdom, and he really did hold Arab tribal councils, and he really did try to listen to the concerns of his people. This is very core fundamental element of sort of Arab tribal custom and what has been referred to, quote-unquote, as desert democracy, this idea that those that would rule or those that would have authority over the people will have to consult with them. It's a basic core principle. And there's less sentiment that Abdullah II follows that. And if Lieutenant Sezbek gets killed and is murdered and the video is put on television and his family reacts and wonders why, and the other key point here that's been his family has asked for is they want more insight into what the negotiation process is like. And it puts a lot of pressure on the kin because he needs to be viewed as a kin of action. Well, there's already murmurs of discontent that he isn't a kin of action, that he isn't involved with the daily life and the daily concerns of his subjects. This does add more pressure. And that does add more, it does take away some of that political, social capital that the monarchy has. And that will be an issue we'll have to contend with moving into the future.
Well, my understanding is that the Israeli right have all already made it clear that if anything happens to Jordan, Israel will invade. Anything happens to the king, and if there's any kind of destabilization of the regime, that they would act militarily. And we already know that Prime Minister Netanyahu was a bull in a china shop. He tried to goad Hezbollah into a war by killing the Iranian general on the Golan Heights. And he's coming over here to speak to Congress as a deliberate insult to President Obama ahead of his election. So, you know, there's a kind of wild card in this, isn't there, that Israel could at least the Israeli right, could make life even more difficult. Because the idea that they at the end of the day, are King Abdullah's guarantor, that doesn't play well in the Islamic world.
That would be, that is a very interesting analysis. That would be a nightmare scenario, both for U.S. policy, but also for U.S. foreign policy and relations with the rest of the Arab world, as you pointed out. You know, it's sort of an unspoken reality in the region that Jordan is the red line for both the United States, Israel, number of Western allies, Western Europe, and also nations such as Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, that Jordan is really the shield in the north to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's energy resources being particularly important to the global economy as a swing producer, but also as the holder of the largest reserves in the world, but also the fifth largest shale, both by some estimates, that Saudi security is intimately linked to Jordanian security. And if in the event that Jordan began to crumble and there was widespread revolt against the monarchy, and not just the Islamic State, but you had sort of the other threat to Jordan that is present, members of other militant Salafist groups like Al-Qaeda, for example, that are their fellow ideological runners of the Islamic State, whether it's Jabhat al-Nusra, which is powerful in Syria, or other iterations of it, that you reach that point where you have that much discontent and revolt against the Jordanian monarchy, and you had the Israelis invade, and you had an Israeli presence there, that would be enormous, enormous repercussions for that. And it could even increase the call for jihad against Western nations and their interests. But also, it would come to expose the fundamental question of what exactly the future role of these Arab partners of the United States, and the tacit acknowledgement that in order for them to be partners of the United States, they also have to interact with Israel on a strategic defensive level. And that would create enormous issues.
So this is a much more complicated situation, far beyond the television headlines of prisoners being beheaded.
It is extremely complicated, and there are many different shatter points that could cause even more damage, destruction, raise many fundamental questions of the future of the United States and international posture in the Middle East.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back getting an analysis from a leading expert on oil and gas on the major shakeup underway in Saudi Arabia.
اكتب وخطب القلم بالقلم اكتب وخطب القلم دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Fadel Gheit, who is the Managing Director for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. He has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and was previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fadel Gheit.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us, Fadel. And I was hoping we could get an analysis on this major shakeup underway in Saudi Arabia as the new king reshuffles ministries and fires ministers while giving his subjects a gift of a $20 billion bonus payout to government workers, at the same time keeping the price of oil low as the Saudis flood the market, which is already driving the frackers out of business and causing American oil giants like Chevron to post 30% losses in quarterly earnings. So that's what's on the plate for you, Fadel.
Well, there are a couple of things that we have to realize, that oil prices 8 or 9 months ago were close to $100, and today they are less than $50. And the rapid decline obviously took the industry by surprise and even shocked OPEC. Unfortunately, OPEC has not been able to formulate a long-term strategy to keep oil prices from overheating or collapsing. And in the recent meeting, obviously, it was a stalemate. They could not agree on the magnitude of the necessary cuts to bring up oil prices, because five of the oil companies cannot even produce their current production quota. So they are all looking for Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and United Arab Emirates to carry most of the production cuts, and they will enjoy, obviously, the benefit of higher oil prices, but they don't have to cut production. So obviously, the Saudi government said absolutely that's not going to happen, because every time they have done that in the past, cutting production, in order for them to revive sagging oil prices, when they came back to the market, they discovered that other OPEC producers and non-OPEC producers such as Russia, Mexico, and Norway are taking their market share. So Saudi Arabia basically is in it for the long haul. In addition to the economic impact on OPEC and Saudi Arabia and other oil producers, there are also geopolitical factors, in my view, that are behind the OPEC strategy or the Saudi oil strategy. And that is basically putting pressure on both Iran and Russia because of their basically activities in the Middle East, which Saudi Arabia, and rightfully so, I think this is a very detrimental and could destabilize the country, and they'd rather see lower oil prices for you know, whatever it takes in order for them to bring some behavior modification to Iran and Russia.
Well, clearly, they, in terms of Syria, they are upset with Russia's support of Assad. But there is a schizophrenia there that both the Saudis and the Americans have about how to deal with Daesh, the so-called Islamic State. On the one hand, we're allied, in effect, with Iran against the Islamic State in Iraq, but we're helping out Assad by bombing them in Syria. And the Saudis clearly were very upset that President Obama, at least King Abdullah was, that President Obama reneged on his red line to go after the Assads after the chemical weapons attack.
It's unfortunate because we are like strange bedfellows. We have common interests with Iran in order for us to put pressure on, you know, on ISIS. ISIS basically a bunch of criminals. They are former army officers and recruits from Western countries. basically, you know, took advantage of the weak government in Baghdad, followed bad strategies, you know, punished the Sunnis in favor of Shias, and created a wedge between the two factions, and before you know it, it engulfed the entire region in what could be a very, very long war, and there is no really a quick answer for it.
Well, you mentioned the Saudis in terms of keeping the oil price low, but Fadel Gaid are in it for the long haul. There have been indications from the oil minister, Ali Al-Naimi, who has made similar statements. He made a statement a while back saying that they were going to get rid of marginal producers, which I assume meant the frackers. And already Chevron's pulled out of Poland, where it invested in a big fracking project there. Its profits are down 30%. Al-Nemi's also, at a recent speech, talked about how over the long term there's going to be a decrease in demand as people shift to other energy sources, and that global warming was a factor. And I take it that the Saudis recognize that perhaps in 20 years' time, I don't know whether oil will be illegal, but it certainly will be discouraged if climate change continues the way it is.
Fortunately, OPEC has failed to really diversify its economy over the last 40 years. They had numerous chances to do that. They enjoyed, obviously, very inflated oil prices for a long period of time. And as a result of the higher oil prices, the U.S. oil industry became very creative and basically introduced something that OPEC and no other country had ever thought of, and that is the ability to extract oil from shale formation, and that gave birth to the shale revolution, horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing and all these things. This technology is here to stay. This technology will only get better and will enable us to extract more oil at a lower cost for many, many years. And this is something that unfortunately or fortunately, OPEC cannot eliminate. OPEC will be able to depress shale production for a short period of time, but not dramatically for a long period of time. Because as long as we are able to reduce our break-even point to access more of the shale oil, that means that we will be able to withstand, or the U.S. shale industry will be able to withstand pressure of oil prices in the $40, $50, $60. I never thought that higher oil prices were supported by fundamentals. We had a year ago or a year and a half ago, we had oil prices going above $100. They were inflated. And I also don't believe that the $50 or the $40 oil that we had, that we have now, would be, you know, sustainable for a, you know, meaningful period of time. It just simply is not going to work. Higher oil prices over 100 will not be sustainable, but also $50 oil is not sustainable. But OPEC has to accommodate and think long-term that the game has changed and there are new players now, basically the shale producer, that are here to stay. And they will have to claim their share of the market. We are producing over 4 million barrels a day of shale production. And although by cutting capital spending and try to reduce the activity level in face of lower oil prices, that could bring down production growth and ultimately decline production in the next 2 or 3 years. But once oil prices go up again, for whatever reason, the shale producer will go back to do what they do best, and that is basically extract more oil from deeper formation at lower cost.
And again, I'm speaking with Fadel Gait, who's the Managing Director for Oil and Gas Research at Oppenheimer & Company. And of course, it was back in 2008, oil price speculation drove oil up to $147 a barrel. But so would you therefore say, Fadel, that the Senate vote on Keystone the other day makes sense? Because I thought, well, if the frackers are being hurt by the Saudis dropping the price of oil, tar sands doesn't make any economic sense. So does it make economic sense? Because my understanding is that Canadian, dirty Canadian oil needs to get to those Texas Gulf refineries to be refined. But the market for that oil is overseas. They're going to ship refined products away. It's not going to benefit the American consumer.
Well, I have to say I am kind of puzzled by statements from the administration. It's misinformation, it's inaccurate what the administration is putting out for a very simple reason. Number one, the oil sand production is coming to the U.S., but is not coming in a pipeline. It's coming in rail cars. So, the industry is able to move crude oil despite lack of infrastructure, basically pipeline, that is safer, more economic, lower cost, and obviously had much lower footprint, in the areas that the pipeline goes through. The proposed pipeline has been sitting almost under review for 6 years. It makes no sense. In my view, it does not change anything since the oil gets to refineries in our Gulf Coast, but comes through rail. It costs about $9. The pipeline, the cost per barrel to move oil from Western Canada to our Gulf region is going to be between $2 to $4 instead of $9+. It is more cost effective. It is obviously more efficient. We have enough problems with safety problems with moving crude by rail. It's going into highly densely populated areas. You can see them in the east coast of the U.S., in Philadelphia. It's in broad daylight. It's only 2 blocks away from Market Street in the middle of Philadelphia. So, unfortunately, we're looking at a bunch of environmentalists. These are the environmentalist zealots that they really have an agenda, but they do not really understand the issue. The world needs more production to make sure that we have plenty for everybody. Ultimately, I think oil will be replaced. Probably intermediary is going to be by natural gas. And then ultimately, we will have new sources, renewables, and all this. But for the time being, transportation is basically the lifeblood for the global economy. And the only viable fuel for transportation as we speak is crude oil, refined product, gasoline, diesel, and so. So the politics when it comes to oil infrastructure is just like really for the environmentalists to declare victory, but it's really not a full victory, because the oil will still come from Western Canada to the intended location in the Gulf region. So I don't know why we're doing that. The other thing is very important. People have to realize that only U.S. refineries can process heavy crude. Not many refineries around the world are able to process crude. But the Canadian oil that comes to the U.S. goes into refineries in the U.S., converted into product like gasoline and diesel, and that is exported now. The U.S. is now the largest exporter of refined product. 3 years ago, we were the largest importer of refined product. So It is good for our economy, is good for the industry, for the refining industry, and good for the consumer. We're paying a lot less for gasoline today than we have paid in the last 10 years.
Well, but my understanding is that the Canadian area where the oil is being extracted is paying an incredible environmental cost because enormous amounts of water are used to separate the tar from the sands. And then this water is permanently polluted and stored in vast ponds. So will we reach a point where water is more valuable than oil?
Well, a couple of things. I have been to the Canadian Oil Sand Project. The people, I wish we have a documentary to educate and inform the public, not influence, just inform them to make sure that they understand the issues and understand what's all about. This is a remote area in Western Canada. You can fly over it. It's like over an hour flight. It's like a huge amount of bitumen there. Which is extracted through surface mining. And now we have the in-situ process, which basically injecting steam into so you don't disturb the soil or anything like that. So the industry is doing everything possible to really reduce the environmental impact and have done that very successfully. We have very high level of water recycling. The ponds that you mentioned, these are fact of life. We've been doing that. They are all, they have lining, so there is no leaching in the soil. There is no, environmental. The Canadian government, both the federal as well as the provincial government, they are very aware of that. They are, they have their environmental antennas up, 24/7. We are telling the Canadian that you are not guarding the environment, but we will guard it for you. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, this is not going to be your comments are not going to be welcomed by the many environmentalists listening to us.
As I said, we have to really we are here to state facts. I mean, we're not taking positions. I'm not a politician, but the fact of the matter is, the world needs oil in order for us. We keep saying income inequality and the gap between the rich and the poor, whatever. One key element here: access to energy. There are 2 billion people living in around the world that have no access to modern energy. They don't go through to their homes and flip a switch and all of a sudden, there's air conditioning, there's light, there's this, there's that. There are little girls 7 years or younger, they are spending 10 hours a day collecting twigs, throughout the world in order for them at the end of the day to bring a load of this quote-unquote fuel in order for them, for the mothers to make dinner. So, people, it's very easy for us clean air and clean water and clean everything, but we go around on the grove and say, look what happened to billions of poor people around the world. They cannot eat. They don't have, shelter. They don't have, things have to come to a balance, and unfortunately, we have the politicians are, the political atmosphere is very polarized, and because everybody is pursuing an agenda, it's not middle ground, is extreme. So I am not at all for the oil industry to go drill baby drill and cause environmental damage, but I also have to recognize that we have an obligation to basically, capitalize on whatever Mother Nature gave us in a responsible way.
Well, Fidel Guide, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Fidel Guite, who's a managing director for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. He has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the difference between the Muslim political thinking and that of the West. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And we've had statements just in the last few days from Senator Lindsey Graham condemning the president for not calling the U.S. confrontation with the Islamic State a religious war. And President Obama countered in an interview with Fareed Zakaria saying that the problem is not with the 99% of Muslims, but an element within the religion that Obama said have embraced a nihilistic, violent, and almost medieval interpretation of Islam. So who is he referring to there, do you think? I mean, it sounds like he's referring to, obviously, we know he's referring to the Islamic State, but many people argue that the Saudi Arabians also have a very medieval and reactionary version of Islam that they propagate around the world with extraordinary amounts of petrodollars.
Well, indeed, they do. And in the long run, probably Saudi support for the extremist movements, which have ultimately sort of morphed into jihadi movements. That's not the Saudi intention necessarily, but that's what the result has been. Probably more dangerous by far to a far greater region than the Islamic State or ISIS has itself been.
Well, there's a lot of big shakeup going on in Saudi Arabia. Various ministries have been closed down. Ministers have been fired. There's a new sheriff in town, if you will, with a new king, even though he's apparently suffers from Alzheimer's and had a stroke. He seems to be moving fairly quickly. But I would think that given the activities of the Islamic State and now the possibility that they could even destabilize Jordan further by executing that pilot, having just executed or beheaded the Japanese journalist. The dynamic that they create by claiming to be the new caliphate, doesn't that push Saudi Arabia further into religious conservatism and fundamentalism? Because these guys are trying to the Daesh people are trying to, you know, capture their right flank, so as to speak.
Well, that's right. It is a supreme challenge to Saudi Arabia, particularly since the king prides himself on the title of the custodian of the holy places, which is more important in Islam than even kingship is. So, yes, there's a challenge there, but as a matter of fact, the Saudis are challenged religiously from a number of aspects, including the Muslim Brotherhood, which by comparison with anything in Saudi Arabia and certainly in the Islamic State is extremely moderate and nonviolent, essentially trying to work through democratic means. This Saudi Arabia also sees as a threat, and the Brotherhood has some mantle of legitimacy in that it's been around for a very long time and speaks in the name of looking for some kind of Islamic governance. So it's really, in the end, not just a struggle over ideology or theology, but much more a struggle for power and for the preservation of the Saudi kingdom that can be threatened, than the royal family that can be threatened by challenges to its religious legitimacy.
Well, your latest blog, Graham Fuller, and how do people get your blog, by the way?
It's just GrahamEFuller.com.
That's G-R-A-H-A-M, EFuller.com. Right. Your latest blog on Muslims and nationalism, A Different Model, you point out that the West is sort of, its model has been the nation state. And of course, Europe itself, World War I and World War II are brought about by clashes with nation states. So we don't actually have a particularly good record in terms of nation states. Conversely, in the Middle East and the Islamic world, there's this notion of the Ummah. And many scholars have argued, for example, that the last time there was stability in the Middle East was under the 800-year-long Ottoman Empire, which in effect was a kind of Ummah, I suppose. So describe these differences between the Muslim world and the West in terms of historic, cultural, and religious strains in Islamic political thinking.
Sure. Well, I mean, the whole world over time has evolved, and it's thinking about what the role of the state is and what the foundation of the state is and who it represents and all that kind of thing. But starting you can debate when exactly, 250 years ago, the West began to gravitate much more strongly to the idea of the foundation of nation states. And this was no longer under necessarily kings or dynasties, but in the name of the people. And the people essentially were ethnically based. So if you were in France, in the emerging French state, you were French, and you owed your entire loyalty to the idea of being French and to the nation state. And that was the supreme value, political value. And in Germany, although the German state didn't come into full existence much later on, there was this sense of the Germanness, the German state, the German ethnic thing. And in Italy and Hungary and elsewhere, these ideas, indeed Zionism itself in a way, came out of this, the ethnically based foundation of loyalty and obligation. So obviously this is pretty narrow, even though states, France, Germany, and others, especially France, really committed considerable degree of violence against other non-purely French minorities and saying, now, wait a minute, we're all going to be French from now on. But anyway, as you commented and as I'd commented earlier, these very narrow, often chauvinistic ideals of a nation state did lead ultimately to the kinds of terrible conflicts that we saw in World War I and later on in World War II. In other words, I think humanity has been thinking there's got to be some higher ideal in the end than just the narrow nation state. And that's where the EU began to come into existence, because they saw they couldn't go there again. But meanwhile, the West has been pushing this idea of the nation state, and it's bounded by an ethnic group, whatever that group is or however it's defined. They've been pushing that, and I think the Muslim model is somewhat, very considerably, taking an opposite take on that view of the state.
So in terms of the West meddling and manipulating the Middle East, and which is a part of the grievance that many in the Middle East have, and of course now we are witnessing the irrelevance of the Sykes-Picot borders, which the Islamic State very, very pointedly bulldozed the berm between Iraq and Syria, delineated the Sykes-Picot line. Give us a sense then of how the Western history of the Middle East is backfiring in that sense.
Well, indeed, you referred to the Sykes-Picot Treaty, which attempted to set up a number of new nation states, creating Jordan and Syria and the various states ultimately that came into being in the Gulf, elsewhere around the region. The classical Islamic sense of the state rejects outright the idea of ethnicity as a founding principle of the state. This is seen as retrogressive, it's seen as narrow, it's seen as the source of potential conflict among peoples when it's all... And indeed, the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad themselves have all said that, you know, he who is the, I don't remember the exact wording, but to the effect that he who is closest to God or is close in God's eyes are those who live righteous lives, and not whether you're black or white or Arab or Persian. So very much the idea of a broad shared religious association has been the guiding principle of most Islamic thinkers, and even today the Muslim Brotherhood and others would say, in the long run, we want to get back to something bigger. This is the idea of the caliphate as well, whoever he is or however he rules. It's some sense of unity. And indeed, ISIS, or the Islamic State, has been one of many groups trying to take advantage of this, even exploit the idea of, hey, we're trying to get back to this classic sense of religion, which should be above all narrow ethnic loyalties and borders, in effect, should come down. That's the challenge. It's Islamic government has been no better or no worse for most of history than any other place. Sadly, today, governance in the Muslim world has been lacking democracy. Dictatorship has been supported consistently in the 20th century by the West to serve their own interests. So the idea of the nation state, I think, leaves a bad taste in many Muslims' mouths, but there hasn't been any serious leader who's been able to be a spokesman for the broader idea of greater Islamic unity. God knows ISIS couldn't be a more terrible example of how this should be, but it doesn't have to be that way. There's no reason why it isn't even consistent ultimately with democracy.
But how do you then explain tribalism in the Middle East? We were talking about in the first segment about the pressure that the King Abdullah of Jordan is under, because the captured Jordanian pilot belongs to a very influential tribe. They're very unhappy that he hasn't been released, and you know it's possible that the Islamic State could behead him just to destabilize the kingdom. So when you have this tribal affiliations, that's even greater atomization than the nation state.
Well, that's exactly right, Ian. And Islam abhors the idea of tribalism. It speaks in the most derogatory terms of tribes as being, you know, almost despicably narrow. But why do we have tribes? People go to tribes and join in these groups for self-protection. You go to where you're going to be protected, your relatives, your clans. In hard times, who's going to take you in except your clan or your tribe? And it's been hard times in the Middle East for quite a long time. So that's what is driving the sense of tribalism. But I think anybody can see that once you begin to have halfway decent governance, where people begin to trust the state a little more and not look to the tribe as their sole source of insurance and salvation, then the idea of an expanded vision of governance can emerge. But right now, the intensity of tribalism is in part a sign that you can't trust anybody else to look out for you except your own narrow clan and tribe.
So it seems to me that there's a real confusion then in a very basic way in the Middle East, and that is you have the aspiration of many for the Ummah, for the ultimate unity of the Islamic world under Sharia and under the Quran, if you will. And then you've got the reality of corrupt nation states where people resort to tribal affiliations in order to survive. So there really is a huge gap then between the aspirations and the reality, and there doesn't seem to be anything in the middle.
Well, you're right. In theory, even a functioning, a well-functioning nation state, if you could ever define what it was going to be. Egypt, for example, you could begin to define as a nation state. It's been around thousands and thousands of years, and it's a fairly coherent geographical area, and reasonably coherent ethnic group as much as you get in the Middle East. That you could sort of argue. But in the long run, it's been bad governance and not as such the nation state or indeed even Islamic rule. So the trick is, how do you square these principles of unity of religious communities with good governance? And that's what Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood and others have been talking about for a very, very long time now. Even under Sharia law, that phrase is tossed about quite a bit. But nobody really agrees even on what Sharia law is or how you interpret it. You can't go out and buy a book of Sharia law in any bookstore. This is a concept. It's how we think we should apply some religious values. In Saudi Arabia, they may say, well, we do it by stoning adulterers and chopping off the hands of thieves. Other Islamic thinkers, such as the main religious leader in Tunisia today, there are many others who say, no, we have to interpret this in contemporary circumstances. And just because it worked for the Prophet, these particular legislations, some 1,500 years ago, doesn't mean that our thinking doesn't advance about how to understand our own religion. So that's I think, where the great ideological and intellectual ferment is coming from.
Well, just in closing then, obviously when I quoted at the beginning Lindsey Graham, who says we should refer to what's going on with the Islamic State as a religious war, and the president saying the opposite, why is it that we somehow... we talk, as the president did, that 99% of the Muslim world are against the Islamic State. But we don't seem to be able to win over that 99%.
No, we don't. And furthermore, the danger of a guy like Lindsey Graham, and God knows he's not alone, there are lots and lots of other people, neoconservative thinkers and others, who do like to say, yes, this is all about a struggle between Islam and Christianity, or Islam and Western values. Ironically, the ultra conservative Islamists, Salafis and such in Saudi Arabia, agree with the neoconservatives and say that's exactly what it is. It's a struggle between these two visions of faith. But in the end, it really isn't that. If you tell me that we are basically facing a struggle between two religions, there's no solution to that, Ian. What can I do? What can you do to change such a situation? But if we start saying, look, there are concrete problems between certain states there and ourselves, and we need to sit down and work out the nature of these problems. They're not insoluble. If you call them ideological and religious, they're insoluble. But that's what the Lindsey Grahams of the world want, to continue this 100-year war, whatever they want to call it, against Islam, and continue military intervention, which has just brought an increase of all of this stuff.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.